Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله اللَّهِ ثُمَّ لَا يُتْبِعُونَ مَا أَنْفَقُوا مَنًّا وَلَا أَذَى ثُمَّ لَا يُتْبِعُونَ مَا أَنْفَقُوا مَنًّا وَلَا أَذَى لَهُمْ أَجْرُهُمْ عِنْدَ رَبِّهِمْ ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran and China say they will speed up the implementation of a landmark 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties between the two countries. The UN says it lacks first-hand information about a deadly attack on a prisoner facility in eastern Ukraine as Russia and Ukraine accuse each other of targeting the camp. And Tunisia summons the U.S. chargé d'affaires over remarks by American officials criticizing this week's constitutional vote in the North African country. Thank you for joining us. Iran's president tells his Chinese counterpart that Tehran supports the One China principle. Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran has always respected the territorial integrity of other countries as a key policy.
Respecting the national sovereignty and territorial integrity of countries is among the fundamental principles of the Islamic Republic of Iran's foreign policy. Within the same framework, backing the One China policy is the principled and definite policy of the Islamic Republic.
During the phone conversation, Raisi also condemned the United States for interference in the internal affairs of other countries. The president said Washington follows a destructive policy of unilateralism, which is now threatening global peace and security. China's Xi Jinping, for his part, said Iran has played a constructive role in maintaining regional stability. The two presidents also discussed ways to speed up the implementation of a landmark 25-year cooperation agreement between Beijing and Tehran. The deal is aimed at strengthening economic and political ties between the two countries. Iran's foreign ministry has warned about the threat posed by Israel's advanced military nuclear program and the failure of relevant international bodies to take necessary action. The ministry's spokesman says the apartheid regime's relentless refusal to place its nuclear facilities under comprehensive safeguards poses a serious threat to international security. Nasser Kanani called on the UN Nuclear Agency to fulfill its responsibility in this regard, as stipulated in its statute. He said, accordingly, the International Atomic Energy Agency and its director general must strive toward promoting the peaceful applications of nuclear energy and non-diversion from those objectives. Israel is believed to have a stockpile of up to 400 nuclear warheads, but the regime maintains a policy of ambiguity in this regard. It refuses to either allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Palestinians are having no respite from Israeli atrocities as the regime's forces kill another teenager in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says the 16-year-old died of critical wounds sustained by live bullets in the chest. Another Palestinian was also shot and wounded by Israeli forces. The Palestinians were holding a demonstration near Ramallah against Israeli settlements when they came under attack by the regime's forces and settlers. Israel has recently ramped up its violence against Palestinians, killing over 50 since late March. Nearly 700,000 Israeli settlers live in settlements in East Al-Quds and the West Bank. The settlements are built on land captured following the 1967 war and are illegal under international law. We have talked to our West Bank correspondent, Mona Kandil, for more information about the killing of the Palestinian teenager by Israeli forces. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
A 16-year-old Palestinian teenager, Amjad Abu Aliya, from the village of Al Mghayr near Ramallah, was shot dead by Israeli forces, by the fire of Israeli forces and Israeli settlers. This is according to eyewitnesses there. There was an invitation or a call for Palestinians to take part in an anti-Israeli settlement protest because Israeli settlers there, protected and backed by Israeli forces, continue to storm the Al Mghayr village on a daily basis, attack Palestinians, throw stones at them, hit them in order to force them leave their lands because the settlers want to confiscate more lands in the village of Al Mghayr. So Palestinians were protesting there following the Friday prayers, and Israeli settlers raided again the village of Al Mghayr, backed and supported by fully armed Israeli forces. And we have to mention that the Israeli settlers themselves are also armed like the Israeli soldiers. They opened fire at Palestinian protesters there, wounding dozens of them.
The International Committee of the Red Cross is seeking access to a prisoner facility in eastern Ukraine that was destroyed in what appeared to be a missile attack or explosion. The ICRC says it wants to help evacuate the dead and provide treatment to the wounded. It says its personnel are in contact with prisoners' families. At least 50 Ukrainian prisoners were killed and dozens more wounded in the Friday attack in the frontline town of Olenivka, Donetsk province. Moscow and Kiev are accusing each other of responsibility. Russia says the prison was hit by U.S.-made rockets to prevent Ukrainian soldiers from surrendering. Ukraine says Russia conducted the raid to put the blame on Kiev. It also says the U.N. and the Red Cross should investigate the incident. The U.N. says it lacks first-hand information about the attack. Tunisian Foreign Ministry has summoned the U.S. Chargé d'Affaires over remarks by American officials criticizing this week's constitutional vote in the African country. The ministry said it had denounced unacceptable interference in Tunisia's internal affairs. It said remarks by the American officials do not reflect the reality of the situation in Tunisia. The country on Monday held a referendum on a new constitution that grants almost unlimited power to the president. 30.5% of eligible voters took part. Of them, nearly 95% said yes to the new constitution. Now, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has voiced concern that the new constitution could weaken Tunisia's democracy. He said it could erode respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. Similar comments were echoed by ambassadorial nominee Joey Hood. China says it plans to hold military drills near Taiwan amid simmering tensions with the U.S. over the island. The Chinese government says the maneuvers will be held in the Taiwan Strait on Saturday and that any entry into the area will be prohibited. Live ammunition will also be fired during the exercises. The area has been a flashpoint of tensions between Beijing and Washington. China is opposed to the growing military and diplomatic ties between the U.S. and Taiwan. China also considers the island part of its territory and has warned against what it calls U.S. provocations in the region. Earlier, we talked to political commentator Greg Simons to get some perspective on the U.S. stance on Taiwan. Russia has reiterated its backing of the One China policy. Simons said Washington's position on Taipei is similar to its strategy on the Ukrainian conflict, which aims to contain Moscow.
Well, it's pretty clear. I mean, they're taking a very similar strategy and using it against China versus Taiwan as they did between Russia and Ukraine before the war broke out. That this is meant to increase tensions and, I mean, this controlled chaos, which the US hopes to reassert itself as the leading global power, which at the moment is in disarray. What it's doing, it's very similar to what the United States was using between Russia and Ukraine, which was to constrain and contain Russia. And they're using attempting a very similar strategy with China over Taiwan. However, this, of course, what we've seen, the response from Russia to the Ukrainian situation has actually undermined the US strategy. And they're repeating the same strategy again with China and Taiwan. The US, should we say, intellectually, is not what it used to be. It's fighting a very short term and ultimately engaging in a losing strategy.
A survey released by British advocacy group CAGE has revealed shocking feedback regarding British schools pushing Western propaganda on Ukraine while gagging any student activism in support of Palestine. The findings appear to show UK government's involvement with both initiatives to peddle Ukraine sympathy and outlaw Palestine solidarity. Robert Carter reports from London.
A new study has revealed a shocking disparity by British schools, which have gone to great lengths to promote Ukraine solidarity among their students, in stark contrast to how Palestinian solidarity is suppressed in the classroom. Human rights group CAGE carried out the survey, which received 532 responses from parents, students, and teachers. The group said the survey revealed a cavalier attitude to due diligence, including collaboration with organisations with far-right links and the soft penetration of security think tanks and those linked to the UK's so-called Prevent Counter-Extremism programme. Some of the survey's findings include 96% of respondents confirming proactive engagement on the Ukraine issue by their school, including holding non-uniform days, activities, or donation appeals. 62% indicated their school had fundraised or hosted donation drives for Ukraine, while 17% also mentioned schools promote the Ukraine flag, such as hoisting the Ukrainian flag on school grounds. And perhaps most shockingly, alleged funding from some schools was intended to provide military gear for the war. In 2021, Israel's bombing of Gaza drew huge international backlash as millions took to the streets worldwide. British students also joined the outpouring of support for Palestine. However, British schools responded negatively, with students being punished for waving a Palestinian flag or branded racist in some cases for expressing solidarity.
For Palestine, supporting Palestine goes against British foreign policy interests. Support for Ukraine is in line with that, and hence that was allowed and encouraged, and the government even produced guidance for schools into how, and for parents into how they could do so. While for Palestine, the government minister for education at the time, Gavin Williamson, he issued a letter, clear letter to schools, indicating to them that discussion on Palestine needs to be clamped down or managed to such a degree where it can only ever amplify the pro-Israeli, pro-apartheid narrative.
In early July, London's High Court dismissed a legal challenge by Cage against the Department for Education over issuing so-called discriminatory guidance, which was then used by schools to censor and penalise any student who was willing to express solidarity with Palestine, particularly during Israel's bombardment of Gaza last year. This whole saga will have convinced many more that Britain may indeed be biased when looking at conflicts and human rights abuses abroad. Robert Carter, London.
The U.S. political system has been dominated by two main parties, namely the Democrats and the Republicans. Even though there have been other parties, they have been unable to effectively challenge the two major parties so far. But now there appears to be a real push for a third party, a merger of three political groups.
As the political bickering continues to grow in the United States, calls are growing louder for a viable third party there. News has emerged that a group of former Democratic and Republican officials are now trying to form a third party in a bid to challenge the mainstream Republican and Democratic parties. The new party is called Forward. It's a centrist party and appeals to millions of voters who are dissatisfied with the two-party system. According to polls, two-thirds of U.S. citizens believe a third party is needed in the United States.
And the majority of people in this country are not Democrats or Republicans. They are independent. So if there were an opportunity to get on the ballot, I think there would be a lot of support for a third party.
The U.S. political scene has been polarized in recent years. There are now open threats of assassination against rival congressmen and women in the Capitol Hill.
Yeah, there's been a lot of, nasty partisanship. And we've seen that for the past 5-6 years, definitely. People have been at each other's throats. And we do have a situation in which people, I think the majority of people for the first time express they don't want, for example, either Biden or Trump to be president. You know, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with both parties. And there are strong, small factions in each party that are very determined to defeat the other side in a nasty way.
The new party will initially be co-chaired by former Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang and Christine Todd Whitman, the former Republican governor of New Jersey. The party plans to hold events across the U.S. this autumn. It will be officially launched in Houston on September 24. Forward will hold its first national convention next summer. The party is a merger of three political groups that have emerged in recent years. They include the New America Movement, the Forward Party, and the Serve America Movement. The party has described itself as a centrist political institution and is based on the platforms of reinvigorating the U.S. economy and giving Americans more choices in the elections. It aims to field candidates for local races, city council, state houses, the U.S. Congress, and all the way up to the presidency.
I think the worst problem in the United States as far as people's attitude towards the government is the tremendous distrust that people have towards both of the parties. Right now, we see the opinion polls for President Biden way down, but we also see that people don't have confidence in the Republican Party either.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com www.iasnewsnet.org/en.
On Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately, to help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
In the United States, a massive $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit by a voting machine company over Fox News election lies got a whole lot more serious last month when a judge ruled the action can proceed in a scathing ruling against media magnate Rupert Murdoch and his son. The article you're about to hear has been written by Huffington Post journalist Mary Papenfoss. The article was published by Huffington Post and is titled Fox News Potentially Facing Major Financial Damage in Dogged Suit Over Election Lies. A massive $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit by a voting machine company over Fox News election lies got a whole lot more serious last month when a judge ruled the action can proceed in a scathing ruling against media magnate Rupert Murdoch and his son Lachlan. Dominion Voting Systems was given the green light in June to proceed in its lawsuit against both Fox News and Fox Corporation, its parent company, by Delaware Superior Court Judge Eric M. Davis. Judge Davis determined that it was a reasonable inference that Rupert Murdoch and his son Lachlan Murdoch either knew outright that Dominion had not manipulated the election or recklessly disregarded the truth when Fox disseminated lies initially launched by Donald Trump. Conservative news outlets, OAN and Newsmax, have also been sued by Dominion for defamation for $1.6 billion each. Dominion has a very strong case against Fox News. Chiara Torres-Spelisky, a constitutional law professor at Florida Stetson University and fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, told The Guardian. All of the conspiracy theories about Dominion's machines were just pure bunk, she added. The Fox News Channel, as a news organization, should have known that and not given this aspect of Donald Trump's big lie a megaphone. What's particularly bad for Fox, she noted, is that Dominion asked the network to stop disseminating the lies and correct the record. Yet Fox persisted in spreading misrepresentations about the voting machine company. A particularly intriguing development could be the exposure of text and email messages among the Trump White House, Fox News personalities, and even Rupert Murdoch himself. I think once you start to pull the discovery material, what you're going to find is there was a lot of communication between the Trump people, both internally and externally, about pushing very specific lies and narratives. Angelo Carissoni, chief executive of Media Matters for America, told The Guardian. A Fox News Channel spokesman told the newspaper, "We are confident we will prevail in this case, as the First Amendment is the foundation of our democracy and freedom of press must be protected." Delaware judge on Thursday, 21st of July, denied Newsmax's motion to dismiss a $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit filed by Dominion Voting Systems alleging the network's reporting about the voting software company following the 2020 presidential election was false. Judge Eric M. Davis of the Superior Court of Delaware ruled Dominion at this stage has a case for defamation and allowed the company's lawsuit to advance. The complaint supports the reasonable inference that Newsmax either knew its statements about Dominion's role in the election fraud were false or had a high degree of awareness that they were false, Judge Eric Davis wrote in his decision. The judge also said Newsmax continued pushing election fraud claims even though the network knew the allegations were probably false. Newsmax possessed countervailing evidence of election fraud from the Department of Justice, election experts, and Dominion at the time it had been making its statements, Judge Davis wrote. Dominion sued Newsmax Media Incorporated on 9th of August 2021 for $1.6 billion, arguing the right-wing media company deliberately made false statements about the 2020 presidential election and Dominion voting machines. On the same day, Dominion filed two additional defamation lawsuits against One American News Network, OAN, and former Overstock.com chief executive officer Patrick Byrne. Newsmax told Huffington Post it was not surprised by last Thursday's ruling. The same judge ruled in December of 2021 that Dominion's $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit against Fox News could proceed. "We are not surprised by the judge's decision, as this was a preliminary motion, and he made a very similar ruling in the Fox News case," the company said in a statement. Newsmax reported on both sides in the election dispute without making any claim about the results, other than saying they were legal and final. "We are confident that Newsmax will ultimately prevail given the strong First Amendment protections provided to ensure free speech and a free press. The statement continued.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yemeni men, firm faith. Part 2.
Big dreams burn down in these flames. The dreams of a young man who wanted to conquer the world with petrodollars and an iron fist. June 21st, 2017, international media reported that a silent coup was underway in the corridors of power in Riyadh. King Salman, the ailing Saudi monarch, deposed Mohammed bin Nayef, the crown prince, and his nephew, and replaced him with his own son, Mohammed bin Salman. But for many, it wasn't news. On January 10, 2016, The Independent had published an article from Germany's intelligence agency that said they expected King Salman to officially introduce bin Salman as his successor and delegate power. At that time, almost 10 months had passed since the Saudi aggression on Yemen. During the 10 months, the horrifying aspects of the humanitarian crisis came to light. On June 14, 2015, 2 months after the war, the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs reported the spread of dengue fever in Yemen and the deaths of 113 people. Only a few weeks later, on July 1st, the UN described Yemen as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Over 80% of the people needed immediate food and medical aid. The country is just one step away from famine. by besieging Yemen, bin Salman wanted to check the strength of the Ansarullah and Houthi forces and also trigger a popular uprising against the Ansarullah by cutting food supplies. Since the Saudi pilots weren't skillful enough, Saudi bombs would constantly target children, women, schools, and wedding ceremonies. Human Rights Watch reported that 309 civilians were killed in airstrikes until August 30, 2015, less than 6 months since the war. What did Mohammed bin Salman want with this poor nation that's on the verge of famine? How would he benefit from the lethal and bloody airstrikes? Some believe that he had his big dream, the dream of turning Saudi Arabia into the biggest power in the region and turning himself into the most powerful man in West Asia. But his dream faced a big hurdle. Iran, a country that's naturally been the heavyweight in the region for centuries. The Saudis accused Iran of intervention in Yemen and seek to introduce Ansarullah as evidence of Iran's influence in the region. It seems history is repeating itself. The story of Iran in Yemen has started once again. Mohammed bin Salman received intelligence reports that Yemenis are making missiles, but the young crown prince was so confident about the super-modern weapons purchase from the United States that he isn't worried about threats by the impoverished Yemen, especially now that he's managed to win support from various countries. For example, he sought approval from neighbors of Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan for the Saudi invasion of Yemen. Among the Western countries, France, the UK, the US, and Canada all supported Saudi aggression. Among Islamic countries, Bangladesh, the Palestinian Authority, and even the Gaza Strip lent support for the Saudi raid. The support was the outcome of Mohammed bin Salman's diplomatic, political, and economic influence. However, Iran, along with Russia, Iraq, Syria, and the European Union, formed the opposition front. Oman didn't join the Saudi-led coalition and adopted a neutral stance. Indonesia, with the largest Muslim population, and China, with the largest population on the planet, didn't support the Saudi invasion either. Iran had adopted and active diplomacy to defend the national will of Yemenis. The other side of the war was the public opinion. Mohammed bin Salman wanted to depict a young and future-minded image of himself, a man who's come to reform his country. But his record in Yemen didn't help him portray the image. Even worse, two other developments made the dark side of his character more prominent. In the fall in 2017, another soft coup landed bin Salman in a secure place in the pyramid of power in Saudi Arabia. The incident is called the 2017 Purge. About 200 Saudi princes and businessmen were arrested and detained in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. A According to news from Riyadh, Prince Walid bin Talal, a major Citibank and Twitter stockholder who's a known figure in English-speaking countries, was among the detainees. At that time, the New York Times carried a report on November 8th that the detention campaign was the latest move by the Crown Prince to grab power. Next year, some other news tarnished bin Salman's image all across the world.
If Saudi Arabia waited for Mr. Obama to approve an intervention in Yemen, Yemen would have been gone and lost long time ago.
A Saudi journalist named Jamal Khashoggi, after entering the Saudi consulate in Turkey's Istanbul, never came out and disappeared forever. Speculations and comments by Turkish officials said that he was killed. Khashoggi was one of the critics of bin Salman, but no one thought that the young crown prince would murder a journalist in such a gruesome manner without leaving a trace. The consequences of the incident were so harsh that even the U.S. Senate was forced to show a reaction. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee suspended selling arms to Saudi Arabia. The administration of Donald Trump had just taken the helm and had promised to boost job creation, didn't take the suspension seriously. In famous images, Donald Trump talks about selling arms to Saudi Arabia, and Mohammed bin Salman, who is sitting right next to him, seems to be very happy to be in this new situation.
Protection, but if you look in terms of dollars, $3 billion, $533 million, $525 million, that's peanuts for you. Should have increased it.
For bin Salman, Trump's coming to power meant purchasing more weapons. It meant public opinion had less effect on Trump. Without mincing his words, Trump said that he would continue selling arms to Saudi Arabia even after the Khashoggi murder. At the same time, the pressure on Tehran increased. The West accused Iran of sending weapons to Yemen, but Iran also had something to say. April 23, 2018, bombing a wedding ceremony in Yemen by Saudi fighter jets. The casualties were put at about 50. The bride was also one of the fatalities. It wasn't only Iran that felt the danger by Saudi Arabia. Qatar also cut off political ties with the Saudis for a while. Saudi Arabia had accused Doha of supporting terrorism. Even before that, in 1992, Saudi forces launched an attack on Qatar's border and killed two border guards and arrested another. As for Bahrain, Saudi Arabia had deployed its forces to the country to suppress an uprising in that country. The Bahraini people protested Saudi policies. The UAE, that's after business in the region, pursued goals that are different from Saudi Arabia's. Those policies caused rifts among the Houthi opposition forces. Now, they had to pay all of the costs for the Saudi war. This was what Iran had pointed out time and again. During this period, Abdulmalik al-Houthi was keeping a close eye on the developments. The media noticed that he looked very differently. This is not the Abdulmalik during the first days. He's become thinner and emaciated, just like other people in Yemen who are struggling with food shortages. His thin face shows a leader who shares his people's pain and suffering. Abdulmalik had 8 brothers, and he's younger than all of them. In terms of his personality, he's the polar opposite to Mohammed bin Salman. He's from a poor country and wants to defend his people against other Arab countries. These days, he's thinking of military strategies to deal a strike to Saudi Arabia, some strategies to cause concern for his enemy in Riyadh. The winter in 2015, when Ansarullah took control of the capital Sana'a, the Houthis recognized the Yemeni army's missiles arsenal and took possession of all of them. Different missiles were found in the arsenal, ground-to-ground short-range missiles that have a range of 120 kilometers and ground-to-ground medium-range missiles that have a range of 320 kilometers, in addition to 800 Russian Scud-B missiles. But in addition to all of them, Yemen has some missiles that can hit targets as far as 1,000 kilometers away and can easily target the Saudi capital, Riyadh. The West says Iran gave them the missiles, but what's the story? After the fall of Saddam Hussein, the Ba'ath Party was dismantled. However, Ba'ath military personnel went to different Arab countries. Then, Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh hired 200 Iraqi military experts. They formed the body of Yemen's missile system with Iraq's experience and Russian missile systems in Iraq. The Chinese were also involved. On Tuesday, October 4th, 2016, when the U.S. announced that it was going to send 3 warships to the southern shores of Yemen, in fact, it was in response to Ansarullah's attack on an Emirati warship. The attack was carried out with a Chinese anti-tanker C-802 missile. The attack meant that the Ansarullah was now in control of Yemen's territorial waters as well. But the Ansarullah didn't just have missiles in its stockpile. Military drones are another part of the Ansarullah's equipment to fight Saudi Arabia. To track down the threat, Saudi Arabia uses ground-to-air Patriot missiles made by the U.S. that's scheduled to block any ground-to-ground missiles or drones. They're supposed to down the drones or to destroy them mid-air. Yet, the Patriot system has failed to counter Yemeni missiles on numerous occasions. Sometimes it's managed to track the Yemeni missiles, and other times failed to track them. On Saturday, September 14, 2019, Ansarullah prepared to target Aramco oil facility in a major drone strike. Bukayk, in east of Saudi Arabia, is one of the centers of the Aramco state oil company. The Bukaik facilities prepare crude oil for shipment on supertankers. In order to transfer oil to other parts of the world in tankers, sulfide hydrogen has to be removed from it. Bukaik has the biggest facilities in the world for that purpose. Geographically, Bukaik is located in the east of Saudi Arabia, near Bahrain and Qatar and the Persian Gulf. Ants for the drones have to cross a famous desert to reach Saudi Arabia. It's a vast desert that comprises a large part of Saudi Arabia. No village exists there, and no human beings live there either. It means this is the best and most secure option for an attack. Drones are the most inexpensive type of airstrikes, and all countries are in possession of them. Ansarilla has many drones for its operations, probably over 20 of them. The drones were equipped with missiles and flew in two groups. The first group reached above the facilities at 4 o'clock. The anti-missile systems were activated and started shooting, but they failed to down the drones. In the first wave, the storage facilities were set afire. After the first wave, firefighters were deployed to the site to douse the blaze. All of a sudden, the second wave of drone attacks started. The second group of Yemeni drones was above the stores. In the early hours, Bin Salman got the news and became agitated. This is a nightmare that Abdulmalik Houthi staged for Bin Salman. Soon, he received news that Bukaik was hit in the second wave of drone attacks. His big dreams are burning down in these flames. We don't know what the two rivals, Mohammed bin Salman and Abdulmalik Houthi, had in mind. But after sunrise, the massive aftermath of the attack came to light. 5% of the oil production in the world was lost, about half of Saudi Arabia's oil. And it happened exactly when the oil was supposed to be loaded into the tankers. The Houthis knew very well where they had targeted. The bigger target wasn't oil, but a feeling of insecurity for the Saudi officials and the image and position Saudi Arabia considered for itself as leader of the military coalition in the Yemen war. But it seemed that bin Salman was more cautious than angry. No crushing response to the Houthis. What would happen if the Houthis answered the Saudi reaction with a bigger attack? The Patriot missile system has failed to help Saudi Arabia so far, but if the Houthis are accused of the attack, that means that Saudi Arabia has conceded defeat.
It was an affront to international law, and those responsible should be held accountable for their actions.
After 5 years of war, now Abdulmalik al-Houthi has the upper hand. It was unacceptable for Mohammed bin Salman. So, unofficial sources, news agencies, and some Western countries are pointing the finger at Tehran.
If the Iranian regime and the IRGC, they are trying to hide any evidence from the component and with the technology, they are mistaken.
Whenever the Houthis gain a military achievement, Iran is accused. But is Yemen strategic for Iran? Is the horizon on the Red Sea and Indian Ocean and Bab al-Mandab Strait strategically insignificant for Iran? Maybe. Maybe centuries ago, during the Sassanid era, Yemen had strategic importance for Iran, but today the equation has changed. Unlike the past, Iran does not need to be present in a sensitive strait like Bab al-Mandab. The Iranian people know full well what the best strategic weapon is: friendship with the people in other countries. If we view Iran's strategy in that light, the support for the Yemeni people who started the revolution and were attacked by the Saudis will be Iran's best strategic asset. An asset that threatens the greedy regional countries like Saudi Arabia, and it means the story isn't over yet.
In the limelight.
In an advertisement released last year, Blake Masters, a leading candidate in Arizona's Republican Senate primary, cradles a semi-automatic weapon. "This is a short-barreled rifle," he said. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times opinion columnist Michelle Goldberg. The piece is titled, "America May Be Broken Beyond Repair." Advertisement released last year, Blake Masters, a leading candidate in Arizona's Republican Senate primary, cradles a semi-automatic weapon. "This is a short-barreled rifle," he said, ominous music playing in the background. "It wasn't designed for hunting. This is designed to kill people." For Blake Masters, this isn't an argument against allowing such guns to proliferate. Rather, it's an acknowledgement of why access to these weapons is, for the right, a matter of existential importance. "The Second Amendment is not about duck hunting," said Masters. "It's about protecting your family and your country." What's the first thing that the Taliban did when Joe Biden handed them Afghanistan? They took away people's guns. Guns, in this worldview, are a guarantor against government overreach, and government overreach includes attempts to regulate guns. These days, it's barely remarkable when Republicans issue what sounds like threats against those who dare curtail their private arsenals. "I have news for the embarrassment that claims to be our president. Try to take our guns and you'll learn why the Second Amendment was written in the first place," Randy Fine, a state representative in Florida, tweeted on Wednesday. "It will be impossible to do anything about guns in this country, at least at a national level, as long as Democrats depend on the cooperation of a party that holds in reserve the possibility of insurrection. The slaughter of children in Texas has done little to alter this dynamic." Republicans have no intention of letting Democrats pass even modest measures, like strengthened background checks, as long as the Democratic senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema refuse to amend the filibuster. Republicans retain a veto over national policy. Victims of our increasingly frequent mass shootings are collateral damage in a cold civil war. though some Democrats refuse to acknowledge it, let alone fight it. Fine's words echoed Donald Trump's during the 2016 presidential election, when he said that Second Amendment people might be able to stop a President Hillary Clinton from appointing Supreme Court justices. What was once a barely concealed insinuation of violence has morphed, especially since 6 of January 2021, into an even more forthright menace. As ProPublica has reported, dozens of members of the Oath Keepers militia were arrested in connection with the attack on the Capitol. But that hasn't stopped the organization from evolving into a force within the Republican Party. In Shasta County, a conservative part of rural Northern California, a militia-aligned faction has secured a majority on the Board of Supervisors in what members of the movement see as a blueprint that can be deployed nationally. Throughout the country, reported the New York Times, right-wing Republicans are talking more openly and frequently about the use of force as justifiable in opposition to those who dislodged him, meaning Donald Trump, from power. Expecting those same Republicans to collaborate with Democrats on public safety is madness. The horrifying irony, the hideous ratchet, is that the more America is besieged by senseless violence, the more the paramilitary wing of the American right is strengthened. Gun sales in America tend to rise after mass shootings. Republicans responded to the massacre in Uvalde, Texas, by doubling down on calls to arm teachers and harden schools. An article in The Federalist argued that parents must homeschool so that kids can't learn in a controlled environment where guns can be safely carried for self-defense or locked away when not in use.